Welcome. As you're all getting settled in, let me just introduce our speaker. My name is Bill Schniedewind. I'm in the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Cultures at UCLA and also on the steering committee for the Center for Jewish Studies. And on behalf of the UCLA Alan D. Levy Center for Jewish Studies, I'd like to welcome everyone here to today's talk. This is the first in a series of three talks in the winter quarter Bible and its interpreters seminars. We also have talks by Sarah Milstein on February 12th, as well as Mark Lutcher on March 5th. And if you go in the back at the table there, there's a sign-up table where you can sign up. You can get our emails. We promise we won't spam you with anything other than the events. But the Center for Jewish Studies has a really robust program of different kinds of events, conferences, and that's the flyers are there for you. But the email list is a great way to get information about those events. So again, on behalf of the Alan D. Levy Center for Jewish Studies, which sponsors these events, as well as the co-sponsors, the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Cultures, as well as the Center for Religious Studies at UCLA, just want to welcome everyone here. Thank you for coming. I'm really delighted to be able to introduce our speaker here today. Now, I have to say, from the beginning, that I was very, very motivated to bring Dr. Crouch here to UCLA. When I invited her, she was actually a professor at the University of Nottingham in England. So we were bringing her across the pond, as it were. Little did I know when I invited her that she would actually not have to come very far, although braving the 405 and the 134 from Pasadena is still quite a trek, but doesn't take quite as long as the one from Nottingham. Professor Crouch was a professor at the University of Nottingham. She was also the director of the Center for Bible Ethics and Theology at Nottingham. One of the things I really appreciate about her work is not that she's just a very prolific and important scholar, but also that she has a vision for making the Bible relevant and accessible in interesting ways. I really like her popular essay, Why Does the Hebrew Bible Matter? And it really illustrates her vision and ability to work not only on a very deep scholarly level, but also to address general audiences. Professor Crouch is also coming back to California. She actually did her bachelor's degree at Scripps College in Claremont. So this is coming home in a way. She then went to Oxford where she did her PhD. She was a research fellow at the University of Oxford as well as the University of Cambridge. And now she has currently taken a position as the David Allen Hubbard Professor of Old Testament Fuller Theological Seminary. She's a prolific author. She's the author of several books, significant works in the field. There's a book, Warren, Ethics in the Ancient Near East, a really important book, The Making of Israel. Other books include Israel and the Assyrians, as well as a recently published Introduction to the Study of Jeremiah. Today's talk addresses the effects of Nebuchadnezzar's destruction of Jerusalem on Israelite and Judean identities, and is forthcoming with Cambridge University Press. So please join me in welcoming Professor Carly Crouch to UCLA.
Thank you. Thank you all for being here today. There should be a handout eventually making its way around. You'll survive without it, certainly. But if you'd like some of the full references for some of the social scientific material I refer to, it will be on that. Thank you to Bill for the invitation to join with you in conversation today. As he was saying, some of my recent research has been interested in the way that the repeated siege and eventual destruction of the city of Jerusalem by the Babylonians in the early 6th century BCE affected the way that the people who were involved in those processes understood themselves. So the stories they told about themselves, the names they called themselves, and how they conceived of their relationships with others. Now, we might, in this line of thought, attend to a variety of possibilities. We might, for example, consider the way that the name Judah develops as a way of naming those who are left behind in the land after the deportations. Judahites becomes a term for the traumatized people who... How close do I need to be for this? Is that better? Ish? Is it on? I'll take off my heels so that I get a little bit closer to it. One of the drawbacks of being tall. All right. Is that a little bit better? No? Still no? I can use the hand mic if... Or is... Were you messing with the... Should we just use this? All right. That's definitely on. I was going to say, can we actually bring the whole... Yeah. All right. Does that pick up better? Yes? Okay, good. Wonderful. All right. So what I was saying is that my recent research has been interested in the effects of the destruction and conquest of Jerusalem and the surrounding area by the Babylonians and the way that that affected how the people who were involved in that understood themselves, the way they talked about themselves, the kinds of stories they told about themselves, and the kinds of names that they used about themselves. So one possibility or one line of thought that we might think about is the way that the name Judah develops as a way of naming those who are left behind in the land after these deportations, as a traumatized people under Babylonian rule coalesces around a shared attachment to the land. But instead, I'd like to focus today on Israel rather than on Judah, and on the way that Israel's experience of deportation affects the rhetorical and theological focus of the book of Ezekiel. Now, in the interests of time, I'm going to have to take as read that immediately prior to this disaster, so in the late 7th and early 6th century, there are a group of people in Jerusalem who are calling themselves Israel, and that this is a group of some significant social and political power who are especially concentrated in Jerusalem, who are bound together by a range of shared cultural traditions, most notably a commitment to exclusive Yahwism, and by a shared idea of Israel's history. Evidence for that can be found particularly in the book of Jeremiah, whose depictions of Israel, located amongst the Jerusalemite elite, and use shared ideas about Israel's history in order to condemn its failure to follow through on a distinctively Yahwistic manifestation of Israel. Now, when we turn to Ezekiel, these basic contours hold true. The fate of Israel is deeply entangled with the fate of Jerusalem, but there are some equally notable differences. Most prominent amongst them, and on which I'll be focusing this afternoon, is the book's extreme and extremely negative interest in Israel's history, as well as its sustained focus on the homeland from which Israel has been now stripped. Recent work on the political and the social sciences offers several useful heuristic models for making sense of these changes, and in what follows, I'll be referring frequently to that material. My ultimate contention is that the differences between the way that Israel is conceived before and after the Babylonian deportations may be accounted for in terms of the experience and consequences of involuntary migration on individual and community identities, which especially characterized the experience of the author and the audiences of the book of Ezekiel. So then, a few preliminaries. Ezekiel speaks to a community whose members have been forcibly uprooted, deported to Babylonia, and settled in the ancient equivalent of a refugee camp. The core of the book appears to address this audience in the relatively immediate aftermath of the deportations of 597, with the book's dated oracles concentrated around 586. And following the lines of general consensus concerning the book's development, our immediate focus is going to be on the first 39 chapters. So, setting aside for now chapters 40 to 48. The theological crisis posed by Israel's present location in Babylonia is the fulcrum on which Ezekiel turns. And this crisis is explained again and again through references to Israel's past. This is most obvious in Ezekiel 20, in which Israel's ethnogenesis, centered on its peculiar relationship with the Lord, is traced to the Exodus from Egypt. This past forms the foundation from which Ezekiel lobs his accusations against Israel. The house of Israel is in exile because it categorically failed to act as it ought to have acted in response to the Lord's intervention in Egypt, every generation instead teaching its apostasy to the next. Israel exists only because the Lord brought it out, its ancestors out of Egypt. The present generation owes its existence to their descent from those ancestors. But with this came expectations. The present generation can only retain its Israelite identity through the appropriate performance of suitably Israelite behavior, first and foremost, the exclusive worship of its one God. Israel's failure to maintain this exclusive relationship and to follow God's instructions for Israelite living has repeatedly threatened to bring about Israel's end. Yet, whereas the Lord has until now allowed each generation to claim its identity as Israel despite the failure to fulfill the associated expectations, Ezekiel's audience's existence now in exile is a result of the balance having finally tipped in behavior's favor. No longer can the offspring of the house of Israel claim their membership in Israel purely on the basis of genealogical descent. They have to live up to the name. Accounts of the people's dismal history as the precursor to and thus explanatory for their present predicament also underlie the grim litanies of Jerusalem's misdeeds in chapters 16 and 23. The deity's intervention was an act of divine benevolence, but one that was soon repudiated in favor of the enticements of foreigners. Israel Jerusalem builds shrines and idols, lays the Lord's gifts at the feet of other gods, and sacrifices its own children to idolatrous whims. Soon bored with its own imagination, Israel and Jerusalem sought to tempt first the Egyptians, then the Assyrians, and finally the Babylonians, all to come out and make merry. The origins of Israel's wayward tendencies were in Egypt, and thence came generation after generation of the ill advice that led ultimately to Jerusalem's downfall. Jerusalem ends in ruins, a casualty of its rulers' failures to rely solely on the Lord for its preservation. Ezekiel's fixation on the past is apparent not only in these sustained narrative passages in chapters 16, 20, and 23, but also in a number of other sections that take a long view of Israel's current situation. Ezekiel's commissioning, for example, observes that the current house of Israel's rebellion against the Lord is but the latest manifestation of a long history of transgression, beginning with the ancestors and persisting into the present generation of bullheaded children. Even Ezekiel's most focused condemnations of Israelite leadership in chapters 17 and 19 are told from a historical perspective. Similarly, the argument in chapter 18 over the justice of the Lord's punishment is worked out across multiple generations rather than on a truly individual basis. So what are we to make of this peculiar anxiety of Ezekiel's? Recent social scientific research into responses to involuntary migration indicates that sustained attention to history is highly characteristic of involuntary migrant communities, precisely because their present circumstances pose a radical and potentially insurmountable break with the past. Ezekiel's obsessive attention to Israel's past is far from unique. More particularly, we can note that Ezekiel's historicizing tendencies are a response to involuntary migration that is especially prominent, although by no means exclusive to, the kind of isolated migrant camps in which Ezekiel seems to have been located, somewhere in rural Babylonia, along the Kibar River, or the Kibar Canal. This phenomenon has been most extensively documented by the anthropologist Lisa Malhi, whose work amongst Hutu involuntary migrants in Burundi drew attention to the much stronger historicizing tendencies that were exhibited by members of that community who were isolated in a state-run migrant camp at Mishamo in Tanzania when compared to migrant Hutu who had settled independently in urban settings. Again and again, Malki's interviewees articulated their experience, their interpretation of those experiences, their choices about life in the present, and their hopes for life in the future in explicitly historical terms. Now, such a preoccupation serves diverse functions. First and foremost, telling stories about the past helps to hold the community together. As Nicola King explains, identity, or a sense of self, is constructed by and through narrative, that is, the stories we all tell ourselves and each other about our lives. Processing and overcoming trauma demands that survivors figure out how to tell the story of the past in a way that makes coherent sense of the present. History telling is thus a form of meaning making. When we look to the situation of Ezekiel's community with this in mind, we attend to the fact that the Babylonian invasions triggered major changes to, and ultimately the complete breakdown of the principal social and political institutions of Judah and Jerusalem. This was most catastrophically the case in the destruction of the city in 586, but for those deported with Ezekiel to Babylonia, this had already begun in 597. Although the major institutional structures of court and temple would stagger on for a little while longer, the shared community life that had been facilitated by those institutions was already denied to the 597 deportees. When a community has suffered such significant levels of both individual chaos and institutional disruption, ranging in the Israelites' case from the death, division, or disappearance of family members to the disruption of the dynastic line and the loss of temple access. Under these circumstances, telling and retelling the story of the whole community becomes a way of reestablishing social networks that have been broken down by physical dislocation, dismemberment, and death. Social connections that had previously been mediated by shared spaces, such as temple, palace, and home, cut off from these familiar spaces, the deportees' experience mandated the translocation of these social connections into a more abstract and ideological plane. In other words, the effective construction or reconstruction of the imagined community through stories about a shared past. In the absence of daily concrete reminders of a shared communal tradition, stories rise up to fill the gap. They link people together by reminding them of what they share in common. Ezekiel's stories about the past work to bring the surviving Israelites together, even if some of that past is uncomfortable or painful to recall. Indeed, that Ezekiel's recollections of the past are far from idealized, indeed quite the opposite, as is often noted. This draws our attention to another function of historical recollections. One of the consequences of massive trauma is that it impinges on both individuals' and groups' ability to make sense of their surroundings. Why are those who have made it to Kibar still alive when others have died? Why are they in Babylonia when others are still in Jerusalem? What are they living for? Ezekiel serves as a useful example. Though formerly a priest, his routine and his responsibilities, along with the meaning they provided, have been stripped away. How does a priest function with no temple? What purpose does he have in a foreign land? Ezekiel's disorientation would have been mirrored in the lives of countless others. Whatever the details of these deportees' lives prior to 597, they would have looked nothing like their lives in Babylonia. Kathy Koruth, along with numerous others, has argued that in the face of such overwhelming trauma, individuals and communities resort to storytelling as a way of reconstructing meaning. Through narration of the past, the speaker attempts to explain the bare fact of his or her survival. Their narration of history amongst forced migrants similarly constitutes an effort to reconstruct a world turned upside down. Speaking again of the Hutu migrants at Mashamo, Malki observed a remarkable persistence in interviews, in which interviewees would repeatedly circle back to conversations about the past. Having witnessed this phenomenon again and again, Malki concluded that these revisitations work to construct, quote, categorical schemata and thematic configurations that were relevant and meaningful in confronting both the past and the pragmatics of everyday life in the refugee camp. Stories about the past, in other words, were invoked to explain the present, to explain how and why the refugees' lives came to be as they are. Indeed, narrating the past not only functions as an explanation of how the group reached its present situation, but also in the shadow of that disaster, as a guide to the way that its members ought to live now. History, especially disastrous history, points the way towards a better future. And the biblical scholar Daniel Smith Christopher has observed that much of the literature concerned with the destruction of Jerusalem and Judah articulates what he describes as an our-fault theology, in which blame for the disaster is laid in the lap of the people, suggesting, this is Daniel Smith Christopher, that this not only shifts the weight of responsibility, but ironically empowers by offering a hope of cultural recovery. Our own mistakes, he says, offer hopeful possibilities in ways that outside imperial conquest does not. As Malki has argued, the historically orientated storytelling amongst Hutu migrants at Mashamo went far beyond merely recording events. It represented not only a description of the past, nor even merely an evaluation of the past, but a subversive recasting and reinterpretation of it in fundamentally moral terms. That is, the narration of the past served a moralizing purpose. It explained what the migrants had or had not done to bring about their current situation. Ezekiel's narration of the past, in explicitly moral terms, is in keeping with this, invoking the sins of the people's past in order to explain the crisis of the present. As Leslie Allen once put it, the spores of doom sown long ago were now spawning their terrible harvest. This brings us then to Ezekiel's acute interest in Israel's homeland, from which Israel's history of sin has taken it away. The concern over the land and its rightful inhabitants is a pervasive feature of the book's argument, and a point to which it feels obliged to circle back again and again. Its significance is perhaps most immediately apparent from a number of very peculiarly Ezekielian phrases that we might describe as having dirty significance. So Ezekiel 1-39 speaks of the hill country of Israel, the high hill of Israel, the territory of Israel, and the homeland of Israel. Almost all of these phrases are unique to the book, suggesting that they originate with Ezekiel for specific Ezekielian purposes. This acute attention to the homeland again resonates with the responses of involuntary migrants who have been uprooted from their homes and their lands. And again, this is especially prevalent amongst those relegated to camps or similar resettlement communities and have a particular significance in the first generation. This discourse of homeland is very often intensely visceral. Faced with dispossession and dislocation, displaced communities will almost literally attempt to reroute themselves by grounding their continued existence in references to the soil or the dirt of the homeland. The most common of Ezekiel's distinctive land terminology, the homeland of Israel, epitomizes this tendency perfectly. This is literally Israel's dirt, the earth and soil to which it lays claim. Ezekiel is making a particular claim to a particular land, and Adama helps to convey the concreteness of that claim by rooting Israel to the physical dirt of the homeland. The effect of Ezekiel's foregrounded emphasis on the homeland is to convey that those who were once united by a shared residence in that geographical space, although they are now dispersed, will remain united by their shared attachment to that place. As Don Chatty has observed in a substantial analysis of forced displacements in the Middle East over several centuries, This shared memory of and reference to the homeland is one of the most powerful unifying symbols for the dispossessed, serving to maintain and sustain social coherence. That is, the recurring rhetoric of homeland amongst involuntary migrants is, like the propensity of involuntary migrants to return repeatedly to stories about the group's past, is a means of drawing the community together. Although they may not at present live in the land, the membership of the displaced community is able to maintain its cohesiveness through reference to the land. Despite its actual non-possession in the interim, the claims to Israel's homeland in Ezekiel thus provide a crucial kind of stability, in stark contrast to the tumultuous changes which have arisen in and result from the migratory experience itself. Now, inevitably caught up in this discourse of land and homeland are assertions about ownership, and Ezekiel's contention that the deportees represent the chosen people of the Lord. Underlying the rhetoric about the hill country of Israel in chapters 6 and 26, for example, is the exclusivity of the claim being made by the house of Israel at Kibar. Now, part of which makes this such a difficult assertion is that Ezekiel cannot simply assert that the land belongs to the house of Israel, because those who are left in the land, precisely those whom Ezekiel wishes to disenfranchise, are themselves still laying claim to that title. Now, ultimately, Ezekiel's solution to this is simple. The house of Israel that remains in the land must die. The brutal implications of this are clear early, from the description of the death of the land's remaining inhabitants in chapter 6 and the total devastation of the homeland's current mode of existence in chapter 7. At the end of the vision of the abominations in the temple, this ownership dispute comes out in the open. Those left in the land are reduced to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Only those with Ezekiel in Babylonia may now claim the name House of Israel. Accordingly, though they may yet remain living in the homeland of Israel for a little while longer, these inhabitants of Jerusalem have no claim to Israel's land. The land is the homeland of Israel, and to the house of Israel it will be returned. The effect of all of this death and deportation will be a land devoid of inhabitants, empty and waiting for the true house of Israel to return from Babylonia. Ezekiel's sanguine outlook, however, was clearly in contrast with the morale of others in Babylonia. A proverb concerning the homeland of Israel in chapter 12 suggests that the people have become weary of prophets who promise peace and, already disillusioned, are disinclined to believe Ezekiel. So Ezekiel's diatribe against the prophets is aimed against those whose falsehoods cause the people's doubt about the house of Israel's claims to the homeland. That same section seems to also to imply that the deportees' hopes are inversely related to the welfare of the city itself. The exiles considered their claims to the homeland impossible as long as the city persisted in well-being, perhaps recognizing that the depth of the conflict of interest between themselves and those left behind meant that the land would have to be cleared of its current inhabitants, either by death or by deportation, before the deportees themselves could exercise their own claims. Although the parallel is not exact, this association between hope for return and the need for an empty land in order to make that return possible has some resonance with the language with which the Hutu migrants in Mashamo spoke of the Tutsi living in Burundi, emphasizing their illegitimacy and the need for their removal as prerequisite for the migrants' return. As is widely recognized in contemporary discussions of return migration, a major issue arising from the return of involuntary migrants to the homeland concerns the conflicting claims to land that result, as property is contested between those who fled or forced to leave their homes and those who moved into them in their absence. Palestinian claims to land now populated by Israelis are perhaps the most well-known modern example, although the same issues continue to frustrate discussions of, for example, Greek and Turkish claims over Cyprus. The rhetoric with which Ezekiel rejects the legitimacy and the authority of those left behind in the land, most notoriously in his allegorized rejections of Zedekiah in chapters 17 and 19, constitutes the preparatory groundwork for the house of Israel's claim on the land that others yet rule. The critical status of the homeland and its possession for the deportees at Tel Aviv is brought into sharp focus by its prominence in the oracle sequence that begins in chapter 33. The very first thing of which Ezekiel speaks after the fall of the city of Jerusalem concerns the question of who now has rightful claim to the land. The inhabitants of Jerusalem are now the inhabitants of those waste places, but even their bare survival does not mean that the land is now theirs. Their earlier behavior had rendered them morally unfit to possess the land, in implicit contrast to the purged and purified house of Israel at Tel Aviv. The land's repeated devastation until no one survives to claim it clears the way then for Ezekiel's oracles concerning the house of Israel's return in chapters 34 and 36. The extent of Israel's land claims are emphasized by these chapters' increased attention to the hill country of Israel. Although the high hill of Israel, that is, Jerusalem, will be the centerpiece of the Israelite homeland, the scene is one of Israelite dominion over the whole of the land. And indeed, one of the most striking features of these promises is that so many of them remain not directly to the people themselves, but rather to the land. A rhetoric in which the people come and go, but the homeland persists through it all, produces an illusion of landed stability, in utter contrast to the chaotic upheaval of involuntary migration that's undergone by the people themselves. Affection for and pervasive appeals to the homeland amongst involuntary migrants is intimately tied to this need for stability, which the image and the rhetoric of the homeland offers. Whether we are aware of it or not, our sense of self and our sense of community is intimately knit into the fabric of our physical surroundings. To be deprived of those surroundings through the physical upheaval of involuntary migration poses particular challenges to individual and community identities. When we are torn away from familiar places and thrown into unfamiliar ones, our sense of self threatens to destabilize in corresponding measure. One way in which individuals and communities counteract this is to emphasize their persistent connection to the place that they came from. With its physical intransigence, homeland thus functions as a symbolic anchor for those who have been uprooted from their territorial moorings. As long as the land is there, the people who are rooted in it must continue to exist. And again, we must imagine the implications of the Babylonian deportations for everyday lives. How do these people live, whose entire mode of existence has collapsed? Appealing to the physical space in which the community's traditions originated becomes a means of sustaining the continuity of social and cultural inventory. That is, those features that make these people Israel, even as they're forced to find an interim mode of existence in exile. The oracle in Ezekiel 36, addressed to the hill country of Israel, underlines its persistence in the face of threats to its existence. It is because the homeland has persisted, stable and secure, that Ezekiel is able to offer out the hope of return to the land to all of the house of Israel, all of it. Malki writes that in their absence from the homeland, involuntary migrants invent homes and homelands through memories of and claims on places that they can or will no longer corporeally inhabit. As the imagery of the hill country of Israel in bloom, branches and fruit in abundance, the fields tilled and sown vividly conveys, Ezekiel seeks to reroot the house of Israel in the homeland it has, by all appearances, lost. These dreams of the homeland, creatively imagined and reiteratively asserted, emphasize the Babylonian community's ongoing connection to the homeland, even to the point of coining several neologisms for the purpose. To borrow Don Chatty's phrasing, what we see is the imagined community striving to become attached to imagined places. In this, the response of Ezekiel to the landlessness of the involuntary migrant experience is deeply in keeping with the responses of involuntary migrants of other times and places. In broad strokes, Ezekiel underscores the continuity of ideas about Israel around the turn of the 6th century, namely, that Israel is an ethnic entity that conceives of itself as an extended family with a shared story of its origins in Egypt. The Israelites' fate is linked to that story and to its implications for Israelite life together. Israel is still characterized by its exclusive devotion to the one God, with its failures in this regard perceived as the principal cause of its destruction. Although the House of Israel has been riven in two by the deportations to Babylonia, it maintains its special connection to Jerusalem, where its members comprised the kingdom's elites. And yet there are certain notable peculiarities in Ezekiel's idea of Israel, including its much stronger interest in Israel's past history and its much more sustained focus on the homeland. These concerns resonate with the concerns of other involuntary migrants and may be better understood in terms of the involuntary migrant experience of the authors and the audiences of Ezekiel. In particular, they may be understood as attempts to explain the devastation of Jerusalem and the deportation of its inhabitants in terms of Israel's history, linking its sinful past to its disastrous present, with special attention to the dangers of assimilation, and to reiterate the stability of Israel's existence by rooting it to the Levantine homeland. Although this is only one small step towards a much more sustained analysis of the history of the idea of Israel, it suggests that Israel, in the way in which it was described, could change in response to particular social, political, and economic stimuli. This is a potentially rich avenue for future study, and recent research in the social sciences offers a fruitful lens through which these changes might be understood. Thank you.
We have some time for discussion. I'll let Professor Crouch
field questions.
What I understand is that those that went to Babylonia were the wealthy, and the poor stayed in the land of Israel. And also with the temple being destroyed, there was no longer the sacrifice, which is major. And then I understood that many of those people, although they were taken from the land, they were allowed to worship Judaism in Babylonia, and they actually, many stayed there. So how do you think the impact, why didn't they all go back? What made them,
Sure. So this is likewise actually a phenomenon that's quite well attested. So I mentioned very briefly in passing that history, both history and rhetoric of homeland, are particularly significant, especially in the first generation of an involuntary migrant context. There's actually been some really quite interesting longitudinal studies, most especially in the case of the Palestinian diaspora, about the way that relationship to the homeland shifts from generation to generation, and reflecting on the way that generations born in exile, born in diaspora, develop a rather different sort of relationship to the homeland. It becomes an increasingly abstract sort of conceptual way of holding the community together, rather than something to which people have a real desire to return, perhaps to visit, but less so to return. So that would be probably part of what's going on, and part of why Second Isaiah then has to try so hard to persuade some of those descendants to return. Why would we bother to return? We're doing fine here.
What are the estimates of the total number of people involved in the transporting to Babylonia?
Does somebody have 2 Kings around to hand? So there are some numbers given at the back end of 2 Kings about numbers of various thousands of people. There's been a substantial debate amongst biblical scholars and archaeologists over the last 10 to 20 years or so, about what proportion of the population of Jerusalem and Judah were deported to Babylonia. You mentioned that most of those deported were probably the elites. That would be in keeping with Babylonian deportation practices. One of the things that I didn't talk about in this paper, I just sort of alluded to it at the beginning, are those who are left behind in the land. And what happens to them? we see some of that in the book of Jeremiah. And we tend to forget, so even those left behind in the land, they're not, life doesn't simply go on. Jerusalem's destroyed, that center of life and politics and economics is disrupted. There's a reorientation towards mitzvah. There are reports of people who flee into the Transjordan and then come back. There are descriptions of internal migration within Judah, both in the run-up to and then the aftermath of Jerusalem's destruction. So there are, as far as we can tell, all still substantial numbers of people who are left. I mean, the only numbers we have are those given in 2 Kings, which I think are in the low thousands. But we don't have sort of external ways of knowing kind of specific numbers because of the extra biblical evidence. There are a few references here and there, but not in a sort of, you know, there were however many thousand deportees. So. Sorry. I can grab on right here so I can't get away very far. Yes.
I might have come in too late here. Why did you exclude Ezekiel 40-48 in your analysis?
So I just briefly said that I was not going to talk about, which is the short answer, but the slightly longer answer is that what happens in Ezekiel 40-48 is that those chapters are fairly widely recognized as doing a kind of different thing than what's happening in 1-39. So partly my decision is a reflection of that. But it's also a reflection of the fact that the rhetoric around the land changes in those chapters. So the Adamat Yisrael, the homeland of Israel, totally disappears. And what you get are references to Haaretz. So the specific language is part of why I choose to translate Adamat Yisrael. Most people will simply translate land of Israel. But it elides the distinction between Adamat Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael in what I think is a really unhelpful way. So part of that is the decision here to focus on what seems to be the immediate aftermath and attempts to grapple with that, as opposed to 40-48, which seems to be a sort of a later reflection on how do we conceive of homeland. So, yeah.
How were you able to separate collective memory and factual history from Ezekiel's story?
With a whole bunch of footnotes. Sometimes I describe this project as really a project of intellectual history. On the one hand, I care what is happening behind the text insofar as it produces the text. But at the same time, the classic example in here, you know, Ezekiel is great for this. So that Ezekiel is absolutely insistent that Israel is worshiping one God and no other gods. And clearly that's probably not really the case, not least because he's very cross about it and keeps trying to insist that that's what they're supposed to do. And usually people don't complain about things that people aren't doing. So on the one hand, I'm interested in what's behind the text insofar as it's producing, but what I'm especially interested in is the world, the idea of Israel that's produced in those circumstances, which is related to reality, but is not the same thing as reality. And so so this sort of collective memory, Ezekiel's conception of history is particularly, people notice it because it's so negative and compared to other versions of that story. And so the memory as he's shaping it, that collective story is shaped. And, you know, that's something that's discussed a lot in collective memory theory, the way that stories about the past shape in response to the particular needs of the present. So
you keep relating this to modern Palestinians in the homeland, but specifically speaking, Center for Jewish Studies, how do you relate this to modern Jews, say, mm-hmm. in America specifically? Now we have this whole divide of Jews for Israel and against Israel. How, in relating specifically to Ezekiel, is that seen there as well?
Can I plead the fifth for repatriation to America? I can claim the fifth now. I didn't used to be able to do that in England. But I'm particularly conscious, actually, of a lot of the social scientific research that's been done on this. It is, or people's responses to this kind of phenomenon come out of social scientific studies connected to the Palestinian diaspora. It's one of the, in some ways, slightly uncomfortable juxtapositions here. And I'm aware of that. Part of the reason, the very practical reason for that, is has to do with the United Nations Commissions for Refugees and the administrative structure that developed particularly in response to that situation. And so there's a huge amount of documentation that social scientists have drawn on. There's that. There is, I would say, enough of a cross-cultural kind of material now in refugee studies, forced migration studies, involuntary migration studies, depending on what people are calling it, but that I think we can see tendencies across the board. I think one of the things that strikes me about Ezekiel is, and perhaps this is more so in 40 to 48, but the way that the homeland, I think Ezekiel dreams of return to the homeland, but I think that homeland within the book ultimately becomes a symbolic anchor more than, or as much as, a thing to which Ezekiel or his audience truly expect to be able to go back. And so I think Ezekiel is helpful perhaps in helping us maybe to just articulate a little bit or to reflect a little more critically on the way that we can be attached to homelands in quite complex ways sometimes. As an expat, in a different sort of way, but I've been aware of sort of my attachment to the United States or non-attachment to the United States at different stages of that experience, and now my return to it. There's I think interesting reflection. I say sometimes actually to my students that I truly hope they don't understand Ezekiel, because Ezekiel is born out of a kind of experience that I hope most people don't ever experience. That kind of trauma and dislocation. So, yeah.
You, well, what is the high concept of how the Jews survived as Jewish people in exile? Was it because Ezekiel gave them the hope of the temple because he was priest and prophet, or
sure.
Was it because they had the Torah to focus on compared to the Jews in Egypt, which didn't have that?
So the theological answer is because they're the chosen people. The sociological answer is, or seems to be, that the Babylonians have a quite unusual deportation policy. So there is the Assyrians deport people and seem to disperse them across. So when the Northern Kingdom, some of those people are deported, they seem to be scattered. When the Babylonians deport some of the population of the Southern Kingdom, they deport them together. So in the extra-biblical evidence, there's this wonderful thing called Judah Town, Al Yehudu, that the deportees, or at least some of the deportees, seem to have been attached to. And so the Babylonians, one of the things the Babylonians do is when they deport people, they put them in national or ethnic enclaves. From an anthropological perspective, that's exactly what you want to do if you want to preserve identity, is you keep people in relatively isolated groups, and so it reinforces that group's identity over and against others. So that's sort of the sociological, anthropological explanation. Obviously, Ezekiel is doing enormous theological and rhetorical work to persuade those people that there is a reason still to consider themselves A, Israel, and B, worshippers of the one Lord. I think it's a kind of a multifaceted, quite complex, and to which in the end, perhaps we don't really know, other than they did. So I think there's yes, you, and then you.
The origin of your interest in subject, in this subject matter, or what led you into this study?
Well, I suspect from sort of a, if I were to meta-commentate myself, that I've been struck actually by the degree of interest in migration, voluntary or involuntary, amongst increasingly amongst some of my peers. And I suspect one of the reasons for that is that academics tend to go where there is a job, which may or may not be their own homeland. And so there is an increasing amount of, you know, people will go elsewhere for doctoral studies or, you know, and so there is, I think, there's a heightened awareness about identity issues that I think is probably coming to the fore of amongst a lot of biblical scholars because of that. And you know, I participated in that. I did all my work abroad, and so never became more aware I was American than the first day I stepped off a plane in England. More immediately, I was previously working on the Book of Deuteronomy, on the Book of Deuteronomy, and Deuteronomy notoriously refers to its audience as Israel, part of my argument was that Deuteronomy has significant and meaningful roots in the southern kingdom of Judah, and so then that raises a question of why is it that Deuteronomy calls its audience Israel if they live in Judah, and so it's that was sort of the overall impetus for what is this project, which is a small part of this book, which is then part of a long project. So,
yeah. Can you please compare what happened to the Jews in Babylonia with the Jews of Assyria? In Babylonia, they survived, they thrived. Whereas in Assyria, they practically disappeared, probably due to assimilation or, I don't know, I don't have exact details, but they disappeared practically except a very small group. What do you think about these two? Was it because of Ezekiel? No Ezekiel in Assyria.
Not that we know of. I think in some ways you've answered your own question or answered it for me. As far as we know, those who were deported from the northern kingdom of Israel are dispersed. And so it's very difficult to maintain a sense of community when you may not be around anybody, anyone from your homeland, anyone from your own community. When I was in Oxford studying, it was noticeable the Americans would tend to glom together as Americans, and you know, that's not unusual. It's a kind of maintaining a sense of connection to the homeland. But if you're the only one, then, or one of a small number amongst a very mixed population of other sorts. So I alluded a little bit to the way that people tend to respond to migration to urban contexts as opposed to rural contexts, isolated rural contexts, like what Ezekiel seems to be in at the river, the Kibar Canal. Versus what seems to happen when people are settled in major cities, cosmopolitan cities, where there's a much more pragmatic management of identity. So, in some ways it's guessing in the dark because we know so very little about what happens to the deportees of the Northern Kingdom. And we even with the deportees from the Southern Kingdom, we know far less than we'd like. So we can kind of make guesses, but there are an awful lot of missing puzzle pieces.
Well, maybe I can ask one question here. Mm-hmm. And you alluded to this, and you've written about this, but I'd still love to hear you reflect on it a little bit for us. And that is, in Ezekiel, it's noticeable he's only talking about the homeland of Israel. Mm-hmm. And not the homeland of Judah. And even, you alluded to the cuneiform documents that have this Judah town. Mm-hmm. So there's a sense that, they came from Judah. So why is Ezekiel fixated on Israel?
Yeah. So I think The very short answer is that I think prior to the exile, Israel is only part of the population of the Southern Kingdom. And I think it's particularly, as I was describing at the beginning, a group especially concentrated in Jerusalem, particularly associated with the court and the priesthood and other elites. The descriptions of people where we have them in Jeremiah and in parts of Ezekiel suggest a fair amount of association with those in power in the state. And they seem to be distinguished from the wider population. And so I think one of the things that then happens is that the bifurcation of the population, that those who are taken into Babylonia are largely of that elite, people who think of themselves as Israel. And those left behind come to coalesce around the name Judah in a way that that those associated with Ezekiel don't. That said, the last sort of stage of this book that this is a part of is looking at the way that eventually those two entities seem to be brought together as though they're the same thing. And I think that there may be a couple of different pieces. One is that some of those elites were left behind in the land. Ezekiel gives us quite clear evidence of that. So I think that there is a memory of Israel left amongst those left behind in the land. We then have another, at least one, maybe two rounds of deportations. I think that that's probably after some of this, we are attached to Judah, we are Judah, kind of starts to develop between 597 and 586. And then if we think kind of in terms of post-colonial sorts of perspectives and the fact that the Babylonians appear to call these people Judahites. And so, you know, they certainly never call them Israel. And so they put them in a place called the town of Judah. So I think that may also on the Babylonian end start to elide some of that Israel-Judah initial dichotomy. And so such, you know, in different ways on both sides that there becomes increasingly kind of some interchange between those terms, such that then they can be put back together. So.
Thank you. Well, thank you all for coming. With that, I would encourage you all to run out to Amazon and buy Professor Crouch's book, The Making of Israel, very interesting, important work. And we look forward to your new book.
Thank you. Thank you so much.